Ice was not for sale on the open market. It was proprietary, reserved for drones used on state-controlled farms attached to military bases. Technically not military in design or use, but not used anywhere else. Church had a good idea why it was used, and a better one for what the response to its inclusion in the Two Islands strikes would be, but did not share his thoughts. Events like this were better handled by letting others pick the best next card to play. It took them a while to process everything, but Church was a very patient man. It was the South Korean man who came up with the idea.
"None of our countries can look weak," he said without preamble. "None of us can look like villains either, so I think I know how we can actually use this."
The others came to point like a pack of bird dogs, not because of his opening comments, but because South Korea was smiling as he spoke. A tentative smile, but a hopeful one. Church smiled too. "Tell us," he said. Chapter 93. Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea. We joined Bunny and Andrea on the docks and studied the equipment cases. They confirmed everything Doc Holliday and Bugs said about the drones. We even found some dead blowflies, and by dead, I mean ones with broken wings that had been tossed aside as useless. I called it in.
"We're seeing all those goodies," said Doc brightly. "Any chance you can find little old Buggy Bear serial number?"
On the shared line, I heard Bugs say, "Jeez." Andrea checked.
"Nothing."
"Well, I'm as confused as a fart in a fan factory," said Doc. "They keep giving us some clues and then being plumb stingy with the rest."
"She's right," said Bunny. "Video points us at the U.S. and South Korea. Now we find out that the parts are made in Japan and South Korea, but the tracking modules from China. I mean, like, what the actual fuck? This keeps up, we won't know which direction to shoot."
He said it casual as a joke, but we all looked at him.
"What?"
he asked. Then he grunted, as if hearing his own words like an echo.
"Well, shit."
"Huckleberry," I said, using Doc's call sign. "What are the chances that these cases carried all of the UAVs necessary to infect this entire island?" She and Bug had a rapid-fire and highly technical back and forth, and then Doc said,
"Not a chance, sugar."
"Shit," I growled. "Jackpot, talk to me." Andrea was already bent over his computer looking at feeds from his own drones, which he retasked to fly low and close over the boats. We found two other craft, not RHIBs, but pirated mid-sized fishing boats. There was no one on deck, but that didn't mean anything. They would almost certainly have left someone aboard, and it was unlikely in each case that the anchor watches would have committed suicide. We split into two teams. Mun, Top, and Bunny went east. I took Bell and Andrea with me. We ran fast. Everyone knew what we needed to find. Someone alive. Someone who could tell us more than Burke told us.
Though, boy, howdy, it was going to suck to be them if they were still alive.
Top squad found their boat first, about 2 clicks along that side of the coast.
"Pop it, Outlaw,"
he said, and I held up my fist for my team to stop and hunker down behind a big cargo container. "Go for Outlaw."
"Looks like there was a party here," he said. "Two men left on board, but they must have miscalculated with their squid bug or whatever it is. Count about 11 dead civilians, and both of the bad guys. They made a fight of it, but they're deader than shit."
"Copy that, Pappy. Secure the scene and wait on my call." We got up and moved on. The third boat was almost 4 kilometers from where we'd started out, and we were broiling in the oven bags we were wearing for protection. At some point, I will find the designer of this particular generation of hammer suit, make him put one on, and then leave him in the middle of the goddamn Sahara. I was pretty sure I'd sweated off every slice of pizza and every cold beer I'd ever consumed. Andrea was puffing beside me. On my left, Mun ran as lightly as a gazelle, and if I hadn't already taken a strong dislike to her, then her apparent comfort would have soured me. I kept fighting the childish wish that she would trip. She did not. The GPS on the drone sent clear directions to the screens inside our hoods, and we slowed from a run to a careful walk when we were a few hundred yards away. The target was a big 52-foot Trintella 52C, a lifted-keel sailing vessel that had clearly seen better days. Where it was once sleek and elegant, it had obviously encountered a series of calamities because it had all the sad and faded grandeur of a $1,000-a-night call girl who now did $10 hand jobs at truck stops. Dirty, unkempt, patched, and nondescript. We crept close, and Andrea sent a hummingbird drone to scout for signs of life, but before it was even close, there was a subtle shift of weight out of sight and an audible change in the sound of water slapping against the hull. The hummingbird landed on the rail, and Andrea turned the speaker gain all the way up. We could hear someone talking, but faintly, clearly below decks. I had to strain to hear him.
Alpha 4 to Alpha 1, do you copy?
This was repeated three times, and then there was a single frustrated expletive. I smiled and wondered which of the dead men back by the crab plant was Alpha 1. Burke? Or someone else? In my ear, I heard Scott Wilson begin to say, "There is another jammer." Then the comms went dead. Mun started to rise, and I saw that, once again, she had her standard handgun instead of the dart gun.
"Madong," I snapped, my voice low but harsh. "Check your weapon."
It was tough to make her hear me with the muffling effect of the hammer suit while being quiet enough not to alert whoever was on the boat. I used pretty emphatic gestures to make my point. Mun turned to me and smiled and then shot me in the chest. Chapter 94. Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea. I saw her fingers slip into the trigger guard and was moving before she pulled the trigger. It didn't matter. The bullet punched into my sternum with the force of a mule, and I would have gone down hard if it wasn't for the body armor. The catalog says that it diffuses up to 70% of the foot-pounds of any round fired from within 20 feet. Yeah. And maybe that's literary license. With standard Kevlar, I'd be down with a broken sternum and maybe whiplash from the impact. I was in motion, though, and the pain slowed me by a quarter second. It hurt. A whole fucking lot. It did not stop me, though. I swatted the gun from her hand with a hard, fast palm, and her second shot blew past my knee. There is no protective gear in the world that can adequately protect a flexible joint from a hollow point round. I don't know how much it missed by, but I found Jesus in the space of that gap. I brought my own gun up, but Mun used her free hand to chop at my wrist. It was an expert blow, precise and very fast, and my gun went flying from numb fingers. Then she tried to kick me in the balls the same way she'd tried to kick Top earlier. A short, savage front kick that would have crushed my protective cup into my groin hard enough to stall me and give her a chance for something more lethal. I turned and took the blow on the side of my thigh, and it hurt like a bastard. But I was mad now. Mun whipped a knife from a thigh sheath, but I was closing on her now, smashing chest to chest, using my greater weight, trapping the blade between us. I clamped my numb right hand around her waist to keep the knife right there, then headbutted her just about as hard as I could. She must have seen it coming and ducked her head, so instead of smashing the front of my skull against her nose, we hit head to head. Our visors crashed together and cracked. I had the better angle, though, so the huge crash drove her to her knees. Stars exploded in my eyes, but I fought through it, caught her knife wrist, and gave her arm a savage wrench. And this time she did kick me in the balls. It was not a great kick, but it folded me in half. Mun used that moment to try and cut my throat, but I caught her arm and jerked her half around and then swept her standing leg out from under her. She landed on her back, and I stamped her wrist to the ground, trapping the knife. Mun tried another kick, this time catching my thigh. She was cat quick, but I was ready and slipped it. Then Andrea pushed between us. "Scusami, colonello," he said, and shot her four times with his dart gun. Not sure how many darts penetrated the hammer suit, but suddenly Sandman dragged the squirming Major Munn down into darkness and stillness. I staggered back, but immediately turned as a figure rushed up from the cabin of the boat, opening up with an automatic rifle. Andrea and I dove for cover, but he, less damaged and more nimble, rolled to a kneeling position and fired the rest of his magazine at the shooter. The darts dropped him as surely as a bullet to the brain. We stood there, not looking at the unconscious soldier, but at Major Munn. There was a burst of squelch in my ear, and then Wilson was telling me the jammer was off, telling me everything was okay, which it damn well was not. Chapter 95. Aboard the Soul of Piety, Kiel Canal, River Elbe, Germany. They sat in leather swivel chairs and watched the screen, Kuga and Centauro. Forgotten drinks stood sweating on a galley table. Two senior fixers were behind them, bending forward to watch the feed from the body cam of Petty Officer First Class Cletus Burke. The body cam was hidden, covered in a non-reflective one-way film that made it invisible against the material of the hammer suit. The clarity of image, however, was unimpaired. The four of them could see the team of soldiers in similar protective gear. They saw everything and heard everything.
"Can you zoom in on that big guy's face?" demanded Kuga.
Centauro did. The visor was at a bad angle to the sun, catching flares of reflection. It took a while, including running the footage back, before they found a few seconds where the soldier's face was visible. Centauro froze the image and they sat, staring at the screen.
"Jesus Christ," breathed Kuga. "It's him. Shit, Raphael, it's fucking him again."
Centauro shook his head.
"I do not understand. How is he there? That team is supposed to be with the World Health Organization. How in hell is he leading them?"
One of the fixers, a burly Russian, leaned close.
"Do you know him, sir?"
Kuga wheeled around so fast that the fixers recoiled.
"Know him?"
he snarled savagely.
"Yes, I fucking well know him."
Centauro laid his hand on Kuga's arm, but Kuga whipped toward him and slapped it away. Or tried to. Centauro held on, though, and despite the difference in their size and 40 pounds of weight, Kuga could not knock that grip away. The rock steadiness of it, though, also steadied him. He let himself be pulled down to his chair.
"How?"
said Kuga hoarsely.
"I don't understand this. How is it even possible he's there? First Turkey and now this?"
"Sir?"
said the other fixer, a former member of the Filipino secret police.
"Who is that guy? Is he U.S. Special Forces? He sounds American."
"He's a goddamn devil is who he is,"
growled Kuga. Rafael Centauro turned to his men.
"That is Joe Ledger," he said.
"Oh, that's Ledger,"
gasped the Russian.
"Boże mój."
"I thought he looked tougher,"
said the Filipino.
"If you think that, then you're an idiot. Both of you. He'd cut both your dicks off and make you eat them,"
snarled Kuga.
"Now shut up and let me think."
Kuga launched himself from his chair and began pacing like a nervous tiger. The Filipino started to speak, but the Spaniard quickly gestured for him to be silent. The boat lifted on a swell as another watercraft moved past.
"What I do get is the timing of this," said Kuga. "I can understand, Turkey. He was with Violin, and Arclight has been hunting me for a while. Or, at least, they've been hunting the myth of Kuga. That's okay. We anticipated that, provided for it."
He paused and considered Centauro.
"And even if Ledger somehow recognized you at the cafe in Izmir, how did he make the connection to our operation in South Korea?"
"Excuse me, sir,"
said the Filipino,
"but I thought the Department of Military Sciences was closed down."
"It is,"
said Santoro.
So, maybe this Legaga got cut loose. From what I heard, he didn't have a lot of friends in Washington. Maybe he is with the World Health Team. They were hiring experienced operators. This could just be a coincidence.
Kuga considered that, standing there with his hands shoved down into his back pockets, face caught halfway between a scowl and a thoughtful frown.
I can check on that, suggested Santoro. I know some people I can ask.
Do it, said Kuga. Though I'm getting a bad feeling about this, I don't much believe in coincidences.
He stood in silence, looking at the face of Joe Ledger.
With or without the DMS, with or without the Deacon holding his leash, Ledger is just too damned dangerous.
You want him taken off the board, boss, said the Russian. Just say the word. There won't be enough of him left to bury.
Kuga kept watching the screen.
Make it hurt, he said. Make him scream.
Chapter 96. ABC News Channel 6 in Philadelphia. Jim Gardner reporting. Jim Gardner.
We have disturbing breaking news about the growing tensions in the troubled waters near the border of North and South Korea. An hour ago, a Chinese Shenyang J-11 fighter jet buzzed the USS Ronald Reagan in the Yellow Sea, coming within 100 feet of the flight control bridge. The Reagan immediately launched two F-18s to challenge the Chinese fighter and were able to encourage it to withdraw without shots fired. However, the situation escalated when a Chinese Luoyang-class destroyer sailed within 200 feet of the USS Curtis Wilbur. It is believed this was not an action, but was instead a deliberate act of provocation.
Cut to clip of White House Press Secretary Alexandra Marini.
Such a move by the People's Liberation Army naval warship was nothing short of a calculated, deliberate act.
Jim Gardner.
This is the most aggressive and dangerous action China has taken since a similar Chinese warship nearly collided with the USS Decatur several years ago, and is another dangerous step in the direction of open conflict. This is a developing story, and we'll update you as things unfold.
Chapter 97. Yeonpyeong Island, South Korea. There was no more to do on the island. Now that we knew that the bioweapon was being delivered by drones, I asked Church if anyone in the neighborhood had an E-bomb they weren't using. Since the drones were mechanical, the brief but intense energy pulse from an electromagnetic bomb would kill all of them in a microsecond. Doc Holliday said,
Oh, honey, that's sweet that you had an actual idea, but think of the optics. We fire a cruise missile from a surface ship or sub, and suddenly everyone thinks that's a good idea. By the time you explain what we fired and why, the Korean Peninsula would be glowing in the dark.
Yeah, damn it. I complained.
But don't get your Speedo in a knot, she continued. Those little darlings are way too small to carry much of a battery, and from what I can tell, they aren't rigged for solar recharge. I bet half of them are down already. Go find a quiet place to read a book. By the time the choppers get there with the medical teams and backup, I bet you can all strip naked and skip tra-la through the town square.
You worry me sometimes, I told her, but she laughed at me.
We used the time to finish combing the island and used golf carts to do it. Not sure I've ever seen a group of special ops shooters in full combat hazmat suits and armed to the teeth, tooling around at a stately 15 miles per hour. I left Andrea with Mun and our prisoner. He spent his time feeding us real-time intel from the UAVs.
È silenzioso come un cortile delle chiese, colonnello, he said.
Quiet as a churchyard. That was almost true. We found more than 80 infected people, many of them horribly injured. We darted them all. We found more than 300 uninfected people huddled in a big warehouse. Before we entered, we checked for drone flies.
saw too many of them crawling on the windows and doors. I called to the people inside and told them to stay there, to keep all of the doors and windows closed. Help was coming. It was not a massive victory, but we'd take all the wins we could get. As for the kid, Kim Bong, he seemed to be fine. No signs of aberrant behavior. Even so, he would have to go into quarantine at the lab. Doc Holliday was right in her prediction. Right around the time the last of the drone flies stopped buzzing and fell to the ground, we heard the sound of helicopter rotors beating a comforting thump, thump, thump off to the east. There were a lot of them. Maybe 50. As they landed, it lifted my heart to see that there were U.S. military birds, South Korean helos, and four others. Two each from North Korea and China. Flying together in formation. Coming to help. It made me want to cry. Tsushima Island, Japan, Part 5. A soft answer breaks the rage. A tough answer encourages the fury. Solomon. Chapter 98. Aoyotera, the Blue Temple, Tsushima Island, Japan, the Korea Strait. We flew to Tsushima Island, off the coast of Japan, which was the closest neutral ground, a place where we had a lot of friends and enough of a military presence to allow us to vanish into the woodwork. There was a shared facility there, known as the Blue Temple, for some reason I have never been able to discover. It's neither blue nor a temple. It looks like a warehouse for some security-minded corporation, and isn't. There are a lot of surveillance gadgets like motion sensors, cameras, and an electric inner fence line beyond a normal chain link. There are also guards where you wouldn't think to look. The place was officially designated as a secure testing facility for the diseases of aquatic animals. Great if you're an oceanography nerd, but otherwise a big ho-hum, which is precisely the point. About 15% of the facility actually was legitimately studying fish gill fungus or something. Never did get the actual story because I overwhelmingly didn't give a shit. The rest of it was actually privately owned by a mysterious financier named Mr. Kyokai. That's Japanese for church, so, well, you figure it out. The reason we were in Japan was because Burke had been living there. Wilson had some kind of cooperation deal in place with the Toku Shusaku Sengun, the Japanese counterterrorism special forces, and they were doing the legwork to run down Burke's activities. There was some very cautious involvement by NCIS, but trust was a big issue lately. I told Wilson to keep me posted. The guy from the boat, Pavel Benka and Major Munn, were taken to separate interrogations rooms. Both were examined by doctors and left to recover. Sandman does not wear off quickly. Havoc Team shucked our hazmat suits. No quarantine, now that we knew about the blowfly drones. We were checked out by the medical staff and given clean bills of health. All except for my bruised forehead and a throbbing nutsack from where Munn kicked me. It made me walk like an old man recovering from hip replacement. I tried to get Bug on the line, but although he'd dialed into the talk earlier, I couldn't get him. He was running his own field op somewhere in Korea, running down the punk press thing. I instead talked with Nikki Bloom, one of Bug's senior researchers. "I want everything on Major Munn," I told her. "Everything. Dig all the way down to her potty training. She worked for Kingdom, which means she got vetted 9 ways from Sunday, but they missed something, or someone turned her. Maybe it's Santoro and Bolton. I don't know, but I want to know." "On it," she promised. I tried to arrange an orb conference with Church and Doc Holliday, but they were both busy. Doc had the drone now from Geiger Lee Siom and was tearing that apart while also coordinating with John Smar and his bug hunters on the squid protein weapon. I checked with Scott Wilson, and he told me that the political situation around the Korean Peninsula was on a lower boil. Church and his friends inside the four governments had somehow negotiated a temporary truce, pending a full debrief by Havoc and a lot of discreet political levers being pulled. "It's not over, though," I said.
"Well, No, Wilson conceded. But right now everyone has retreated to their respective corners and are content to merely glare.
He made it sound like no big thing, but it was actually huge. 1 minute we were on the brink of war, and now everyone was taking a breather.
This is a very, very weird world.
Not a newsflash, I know, but at least this minute's weirdness was erring on the side of sanity. I wandered into the mess hall, found a quiet corner, and made 3 calls. The first was to Violin, who was in Oslo as part of the Arclight team. Lilith had her and a select few others scouting for very bad guys on their list. Events like the D9 conference drew certain kinds of people like flies. Political opportunists, lobbyists, and also terrorists. Arclight wasn't there to protect the world leaders. They were there to take some shitbags off the board. Violin was, after all, first and foremost, an assassin. One of the very best in the world. I told her about Area 94 and the possible escape of Harcourt Bolton Sr.
Harry doesn't know about that,
she said.
Do you want me to tell him?
Can you do it in a way that won't ruin the poor kid?
I didn't think you cared about him, Joseph.
I sighed. He's a doofus, but he's our doofus, and he deserves a better father than the one he has. Break it to him gently. She laughed, a musical sound.
You pretend to be such a gruff old bear, Joseph, but you are really a sweet man.
If you tell anyone that, I'll deny it. My next call was to my brother Sean. He's been on my mind a lot. Even though he was a cop working homicide cases, his life was normal. A smart and beautiful wife, 2 amazing kids, and actual stability. He was the kind of sane and normal person that I ached to be, but knew I could never be. That had been taken from me years ago, and now all that the 3 people living in my head could hope for were brief moments of calm, of a pretended normalcy. "Hey, Joe," he said when Allie handed him the phone. "You better not be calling to tell me you're going to miss Christmas. I will hunt your ugly ass down, and I'll be there," I said. "Would not miss it for the world. Junie, too? Junie, too. Bring that silly dog of yours, too. Hey, did I tell you I'm getting the kids a dog for Christmas?" We talked for a long time. He'd spotted a 4-month-old monster of a Shepherd Mastiff Doberman mix at a local shelter and put in for adoption. The approval came through the day before, and the shelter agreed to hold the dog until Christmas Eve as a favor. The dog's name was Buck, but he figured the kids would want to rename him. We talked about dogs, we talked about the kids, we talked baseball, and we talked about our dad, who was going to be stepping down as the mayor of Baltimore in January. "Dad's going to rebuild Uncle Jack's old place in Robinwood," said Sean. "And between you and me, I think he's going to ask Cassie Edwards to marry him." Cassie was a social sciences professor at Loyola. Mixed race, elegant, exceptionally graceful, and very much in love with our widowed father. "That's really wonderful," I said, and meant it. Sean must have heard something in my voice. "Everything okay, big brother?" It was a tentative question because Sean knew better than to ask specific questions about where I was or what I was involved with. He'd been tangled up in one of my cases, and it nearly got Allie and the kids killed. "Been a busy couple of days," I said, and let that hang. "Big hug, man," he said. My third call was to Junie. I rarely get her on the phone, but this time lucked out.
"Joe,"
she said, with such light in her voice that it made me want to cry. After that argument in Greece, we hadn't had any time at all to make amends, and I very much wanted to do that. "Junie, listen, she cut me off.
"Don't, Joe, please. I was out of line. I shouldn't have said what I said. I know you're a good man with a good heart. I know that you aren't arrogant or cold or detached."
"You weren't entirely wrong," I said. "Maybe I've become disconnected as some kind of defense mechanism. I don't know. I'll talk to Rudy about it, though. Promise you that."
"I never wanted to hurt you."
"Doing a pretty good job of that myself, babe." I tried to make a joke of it, but the delivery was flat. We switched the subject, shelving important stuff until we were face to face. That was our way, and it was the best way. If the Korea thing was not going to explode, then Church might not need his shooters for the next part. Politicians and spin doctors were no doubt warming up in the batter's circle. That was fine. Christmas was coming, and I did not want to spill a single additional drop of blood. Well, that's a big fat lie. I would love to have been in a room with Rafael Santoro, Harcourt Bolton, and those two blonde kids. Yeah, I bet that would even put me on Santa's nice list. Chapter 99. Oi Otera, the Blue Temple, Tsushima Island, Japan, the Korea Strait. I had some food, sitting alone in my corner. John Smarr sent me a quick message to say he had a whole team of people working to reverse engineer the weapon in order to understand its full functionality. He had that vague and dreamy quality to his voice scientists of my acquaintance get when they have something they'd love to publish but may never be able to do so. It's a danger when working with a covert ops group. His fascination with the bioweapon was obvious. He nicknamed it Rage, which made sense. Major Mon and the mercenary were still sleeping. Sandman packs one hell of a punch, and Andrea had shot them each multiple times. Doc Holliday sent a formula for the right stimulant to bring them out of it moderately quickly and with few side effects. We did not need them dopey and hallucinating. We needed answers so goddamn much I could scream. All of those people on the two islands. So many dead. So many brutally hurt. And those who survived, what would happen when the effect wore off? Would they remember the awful things they did to friends and family? To neighbors? To their own children? How could they ever bear it? I wanted to know the why of this. A tech rang me to say that Church, Doc, and Wilson were all available if I still wanted an orb conference. I did, and headed to a room set aside for that. Top, Bunny, Andrea, and Belle came with me. Calpurnia, I said once the door was closed and the security seals in place, activate the orb.
It would be my pleasure to do that, Joseph,
purred the AI system.
It's wonderful to see you again. You look fit. Have you been working out?
Someone, either Doc or Bug, I haven't found out which, programmed my personal Calpurnia interface so that it speaks to me in this smooth, sexy, late-night jazz radio voice. Top and Bunny turned aside to hide smiles, Belle cocked an eyebrow, and Andrea laughed out loud. The lights dimmed, and for a moment we stood in total darkness. Then a whole different world seemed to appear as if by magic around us. Figures materialized. Mr. Church, somber in a dark suit, seated behind a large desk. Scott Wilson in shirt sleeves, quick and slightly nervous, his face haggard. Doc Holliday, her lab coat open to reveal her embroidered cowboy shirt, her masses of blonde hair piled into a sloppy bun, magic wands sticking out of it like hairpins.
Colonel, said Wilson briskly. Very fine work today. That goes for all of you. It was an exceptionally ugly mission, and for a newly formed team, you did exceptionally well.
Yeah, hooray for us, I said. Before we go any further at all, I need to say for the record that operating with active body cams and comms that are shared outside of the RTI family is bullshit.
It was necessary, countered Wilson.
It was intrusive. It cut down on our operational efficiency. It made us careful in ways that shifted some awareness from combat and teamwork to an audience.
Noted, said Church. He said it in a way that let me know he would ask the same of us again if it suited his needs.
I was under no illusions that my life and the lives of everyone on my team was expendable under the right circumstances, needs of the many and all of that. His eyes were unblinking behind the lenses of his tinted glasses. Wilson, diplomatic as ever, said,
Despite the awkwardness of all that, Colonel, Havoc team performed brilliantly.
Glad you think this was a good day for the good guys, but from where I was standing, this was a shit show from the jump. Colonel Ho is dead and Major Munn is either a traitor or a psycho. The guys who did this are two-thirds mercs and one-third actual active military. So, can anyone tell me what in the wide blue fuck is going on? Andrea pointed to me.
Ditto.
Chapter 100. Lucky Kim's Internet Cafe, Sachon-esque Yongsungnam-do, South Korea. She ran as if the hounds of hell were chasing her. It felt as if that was true. After leaving her apartment, Aineel tried every trick she'd ever read about in novels, everything she'd seen in cop shows, entering a store through one entrance and sneaking out the back, making random turns, doubling back and going different ways, checking for people following her by looking into reflective store windows and the windshields of parked cars. She saw no one. She thought everyone was looking at her, though. The man who'd broken in was the same man who'd tipped her about the massacre, the same one who'd taken her there. So, why try to hurt her? What was the real story? Who was he really working for? The whole world felt like it was ready to blow itself up, and Aineel twice went into fast food restaurants and hid in toilet stalls, her fist jammed into her mouth to keep from screaming. On one side street, she saw a sign for an internet cafe. It was an old place, looking like it had not changed or been cleaned since the late 90s. Grimy tables, old-school computers with bulky monitors. However, against one wall was a row of wall sockets and a sign for pricing of high-speed Wi-Fi. Aineel paid cash for tokens that would buy her access in 15-minute intervals. Two teenagers sat huddled together at one end of the bar, and she climbed onto the stool farthest from them, plugged in her laptop, read the Wi-Fi password off the card she'd gotten from the clerk, and logged onto the net. She fitted her rerouting device into place and turned on the encryption. It was not a real wall, but she felt safe behind it. The screen resolved. Then she nearly screamed out loud. There were three emails from him, the guy she thought she'd blown up. Two from before he showed up, one from 10 minutes ago, telling her he wasn't mad, saying it was a weird accident, asking to get together so he could explain. Aineel nearly slapped her laptop shut and fled. Then a message pinged onto her screen. I am a friend. I know you sent the punk press video. We need to talk. She stared at it. Her messaging was turned off, she was sure of it, and when she checked, it was definitely off. I am a white hat. We are trying to stop a war. How can I prove myself to you? Set the rules for this conversation. Aineel was totally unable to move. There was not enough air left in the world. Everyone and everything faded out into a white nothing, taking all the sound with it. Tell me what you want me to do to prove myself. It was him. It had to be him. And yet, she frowned at the screen. This wasn't how he approached her before. It wasn't the way he phrased anything. Before, it was all about stroking her ego, offering her a huge jump in her reach. This was different. She looked around. Grabbing her laptop and running would be easy. 6 steps to the door and then gone. Could she risk a response? It took her so long to decide that the token box started pinging. Aineel fed in a token, waited, bit her lip, checked that the rerouter and encryption tools were fully functional, waited some more, and then she typed a reply.
Who are you?
A moment later. I'm a computer geek for the people trying to stop everyone from doing stupid shit. And if you use the darknet, my name is Cole Tiger. Aineel felt her heart jump. Cole Tiger. She knew that name. Everyone knew Cole Tiger. He was a legend. People told wild stories about him. The kid who could walk through walls. What they used to call a hacker's hacker.
How did you find me?
Cole Tiger replied very quickly.
I'm the only one who could.
There was a pause.
I want to help you. And I need your help.
Pause.
Help me, Aineel.
And behind her, a voice said it aloud.
"Help me, Anil,"
she shrieked and whirled, falling sideways off the stool. A hand caught her before she crashed to the floor. Chapter 101. Oi Otera, the Blue Temple, Tsushima Island, Japan. "We have a lot to cover," said Church, "and we have some answers. Everyone has been busy. This meeting should allow us to compare notes in a useful way. A picture is emerging, though it is still incomplete. So, let's start with an update on the political ramifications of the two attacks."
"If there are missiles in the air, boss," said Bunny, "please tell me when to duck."
"No missiles," said Church, and even managed a little smile. "I wonder if it hurt." "In fact, the various military forces are in the process of standing down."
"What?"
grunted Bell. "Although wearing body cams and being on a communication channel that was shared with certain individuals in the four concerned governments was an inconvenience."
"More like a pain in my ass,"
muttered Bunny. Andrea offered a fist and they bumped. "The intended effect has exceeded expectations," continued Church without a pause. "Havoc Team, though still believed to be on contract to the World Health Organization, was the voice of reason in an otherwise unreasonable situation. The fact that it was multinational was very useful." He nodded to Bell and Andrea. "The humanity demonstrated by Sergeant Chung with the little girl, the sad but heroic loss of Colonel Ho, and Havoc's obvious efforts to use non-lethal force against the infected civilians all played key roles."
"And you're saying that's why we're not in the middle of a shooting war right now?"
I asked.
"Are you telling me all four governments just simply accept that this wasn't the U.S. and South Korea going off the reservation?"
"In essence," said Church, "yes."
"Can they afford that, though? There's so much currency in it being some kind of American plot."
"Because I've made it clear," said Church, "that I can prove otherwise and that I am willing to do so at the United Nations via the world press, via social media, and through other means."
"Other means?"
asked Bell.
I didn't think Church would reply, but he said,
"Rogue Team International is not the Department of Military Sciences. We do not have a state-sponsored charter, and we are not beholden to any government. There are people who know me and know that it is a mistake to assume that I or my people are under the thumb of any special interest group. I have made that very clear to the people positioned within a number of world governments. Not all of those people are my friends, but they are not interested in becoming my enemy. Please do not think I am boasting."
We were all silent. I more or less spoke for the group by simply shaking my head.
Church continued, "When this matter began, I used this same orb technology to have a series of meetings with key players in the four governments. They were able to help me set up a meeting that ended 20 minutes ago. Bedlam Team, currently in Oslo for the D9 summit, established a secure orb link with the President of the People's Republic of China, the Supreme Leader of North Korea, the President of the Republic of South Korea, and the President of the United States. We spoke at length, and I laid out what we knew about the attacks on Gaegu-Lisiom and Yeonpyeong Island. I explained the nature of the bioweapon and the drones used to deliver it. I made it clear that this drone was intended to be taken as an American device, but is not. The identities of every man and woman belonging to the strike teams were shared. I also made the connection between several of the dead mercenaries and the criminal known as Kuga."
"Since when are you Mr. Candid?"
I asked.
"Since someone tried very hard to start a third world war," said Church.
"Ah," I said. "Point taken. Understand me, Colonel, this was not an easy sell. North Korea, in particular, wants the political leverage this situation so easily offered.
And Kim Jong-un just went with the flow?"
Church gave a thin smile. "North Korea very much needs to remain in the good graces of China. And China does not want a war. Cooler heads prevailed."
"Yay?"
said Bunny, posing it as a question. "Don't get me wrong," said Church. This situation is far from resolved, and it is every bit as fragile as it sounds. We need more than this. We need resolution, answers, and the names of who funded this.
I am confused, Signor Chiesa, said Andrea. Don't we already know this? Isn't Kuga our forfante, our villain? Him and this Rafael Santoro bastardo?
I find it highly doubtful, said Wilson. Remember, they are a concierge service. They are hired to manage an operation like this, but we don't think they are the actual villains.
He paused. Beg pardon, perhaps I phrased that wrong. They are not the ones who ordered this done. They certainly are villains.
Then do we even have a damn clue who hired them?
Asked Top. We're working on that, said Church. Nikki Bloom said she'll have something for us very soon. How soon is soon? I grumped. I felt restless and began to pace. It meant, of course, that I walked through the holographic people. Rudy told me that this was considered bad form, but I offered the counterargument of fuck you. Wilson seemed disconcerted. Doc was delighted and gave me a bawdy comic wink. Church was completely indifferent. If you have questions, Colonel, Church said, ask them. You were a detective before you were a case manager for matters of this kind. I can almost hear your gears turning, so it might be the easier way for us to move this forward. I nodded, but paced another few turns. Then I stopped and turned. Okay, let's take it point by point, I said slowly. Tell me about the strike team. Some of them were Kingsmen. And?
It's more complicated than we told the heads of state, said Wilson. We have Kingsmen, we have closers, we have people who worked for the Jacobi organization, we have former contractors for Blue Diamond Security, including two who were with Majestic 3. And we have one who we know for sure worked security for Harcourt Bolton. Why am I not surprised?
So can we remove the question mark about whether Bolton and Santoro are partners?
Asked Top.
At this point, said Wilson, it would be quite extraordinary if they were not.
What about these blonde kids Burke mentioned, Eve and the guy? Asked Bunny. They're what, Jedi apprentices?
Sith apprentices,
corrected Andrea sotto voce.
Get your pop culture references right, Mezza Sega.
We can assume, said Wilson, they are pretty much that, learning the trade from Santoro, which is a deeply frightening thought. They may be young and impressionable people he recruited and corrupted.
No, I said, I'm not really buying that, or not exactly that.
They were referred to as kids, so we can assume early 20s, maybe late teens, but I doubt that. Let's figure 20s. With Santoro being away for years and then only out for 15 months, I can't buy that he could corrupt two people that completely in so short a period of time. To do what he does takes a kind of pathology with years and years behind it. This is guesswork, but like Church said, I was a cop. People don't just wake up one day and decide they're evil psychopaths.
So?
Asked Andrea.
So? Said Bell. They were probably doing something similar before Santoro recruited them. There may be a record, a pattern of behavior.
Right, I said. Another person suddenly materialized in the orb with us. Nikki Bloom.
I'll start running a check on that, she said, clearly having heard the conversation so far. But we need more to go on.
I looked at my watch. A prisoner should be waking up in about half an hour.
Well, then it downright sucks to be him, said Top.
I turned to him. You and Bell are on him. The second he's awake, I want him begging to unburden his soul. Do what you have to do, but he talks. Feel me? Top and Bell both gave me the kind of grins you never want to see on the faces of someone looking down at you when you're at their mercy, then exited the orb.
I'll get moving on a behavioral pattern search for the blonde kids, said Nikki. All we have is the one name, though, right? Eve? Nothing for the guy?
It's what we have until we talk to the prisoner, I said.
Okay, on it.
She vanished. The orb thing was useful, but also a bit disconcerting. What about Major Munn? I asked. What if she's not a bad guy, but more like Burke, under coercion? We already thought of that, said Church. A team has been sent to take her family into protective custody. I turned to Wilson. How about Burke? He said he was afraid for his family. If they were intimidated, they might have seen Eve or the guy. Wilson nodded. Actually, an FBI hostage rescue team is heading there right now. Chapter 102. Lee Croft Court, Fayetteville, North Carolina. The house was a white two-story with an attached garage. The siding looked old, but it was clean, and the live oak on the front lawn was tall and sturdy. There was a tire swing swaying in the breeze and a couple of bicycles on their sides in the driveway. Grackles chattered in the trees, and the sky above was clear. A white Ford Edge rolled along the street, reached the end of the cul-de-sac, turned, and drove out again. Beyond that, everything was still. Until it wasn't. The quiet of Lee Croft Court was suddenly shattered by the roar of engines and then the sharp squeal of tires on asphalt as six vehicles rushed toward the white house. They screeched to a stop, doors opened, men and women in body armor, ballistic helmets, and assault weapons swarmed the house. The letters FBI were stenciled on chests and backs.
"Go, go, go!"
yelled a stern-faced woman in her mid-40s. Special Agent in Charge Connie Malgar ran toward the front door, her Glock in her hands, as other agents surrounded the house. They did not wait to announce their presence. Their orders were to go in hard and fast and secure the entire Burke family. Burly agents with breaching tools smashed in the front and back doors. Another pair of agents with long crowbars forced the garage door open. More than 24 agents rushed inside, all of them now yelling. So much yelling. And then... none at all. Malgar had gotten as far as the end of the entrance hall and then stopped. Still as a statue. Dead still. Because dead was the defining word. She stood there, her gun pointing down at the floor. Eyes wide. Mouth slack. Everywhere she looked, she saw red. She saw horror. She was so dazed and horrified that she almost did not notice the tiny sting on the back of her hand. Someone made a gagging sound, and she turned to see one of the younger agents turn away, a hand to his mouth. He lumbered toward the door.
"No,"
said Malgar. She thought she said it quietly, but like a muffled echo, her word came back to her so much louder, bigger, raw, and filled with emotion.
"Oh,"
she said.
"I'm sorry."
The younger agent turned in shock and surprise because those words had been shouted too. Special Agent in Charge Connie Malgar shot him in the face. Chapter 103. Aoi Otera. The Blue Temple. Tsushima Island, Japan. We stood there in the orb, watching a horror movie. Except it was in real time, and in the real world. The feeds from the FBI body cams were projected in high definition and vivid color onto a screen, standing in a home filled with some of the most appalling horrors I'd ever seen. A family cut to pieces and hung like decorations for some insane holiday. A dozen agents were slaughtering each other with guns and fists. With teeth. The SAC, Connie Malgar, a woman I'd worked with in the past, stood in the middle of the room shooting anything that moved. Her mouth was moving, but her words were drowned out by the gunfire and screams. I could read her lips. "Oh, I'm sorry." That's what she kept saying as she murdered her colleagues and friends. It was what she was saying just as a bullet took her in the forehead. Malgar went down like a broken toy and lay amid the carnage she had helped to create. No one said anything. No one asked a stupid question like why. We all knew. It was rage. That was how Santoro kept control.
It was the surest punishment for any of his victims of coercion who broke faith. It was how he cleaned up. No risk to any of his people. I bowed my head, heartsick, feeling a great deal of my own rage. Chapter 104. Aoi Otera, The Blue Temple, Interrogation Room 2, Tsushima Island, Japan. Top Sims placed a wooden chair backward, sat down on it facing the prisoner, who was in wrist, ankle, and waist chains, and secured to both a steel chair and the floor. The man wore a plain orange jumpsuit and paper slippers. Bell went and leaned against the wall, slim, quiet, patient, and unexpressive.
"Okay, now," said Top in an almost fatherly tone. "Let's see what we got."
He removed a folded piece of paper from his shirt pocket, opened it, and read.
"Let's see now. You are Pavel Benka, born in the city of Bratislava in the Slovak Republic. You're 34 and used to be a sergeant in the... Hold one, let me see if I can pronounce this right. 5 Pluk Specialneho Urchenia, 5 PSU. Did I get any of that right? The 5th Special Purpose Regiment. Uh-oh! Says you were dishonorably discharged after a charge of aggravated sexual assault. Then you skipped the country as soon as a civil suit was filed by the family of the 14-year-old girl you sodomized. You were recruited by the Seven Kings organization and completed training as a kingsman. Since then, you fell off the damn world, and now you turn up on a boat in South Korea where a whole bunch of innocent people are killing each other."
He sighed and folded the paper again. He kept folding it until it was a paper airplane which he soared over the prisoner's head. Benka glared at him, jaw set, eyes hard.
"What have you got to say for yourself?"
Benka leaned forward.
"Fuck you, nigger."
Top smiled as if it was a pleasant old world. He had a very warm smile.
"You know how long it's been since anyone called me that. I mean, heck, it was back before the PC crowd started calling it the N-word. Been a long time."
Bell chuckled.
"And that goes for the nigger dyke, too," sneered Benka.
Top looked at Bell.
"He's got a way about him, doesn't he? Knows how to make friends?"
She snorted.
"He's not exactly reading the room, Peppy."
Okay, that's fair."
Top stood and fished a key from his pocket. Benka watched with the narrowed eyes of a wary rat as Top bent to unlock the shackles. The metal clattered to the floor. All at once, Benka was in motion, rising from his chair, hooking an arm around Top's neck, pulling the big Sig Sauer from the holster around Top's waist, pressing the barrel against the thin hair on Top's temple. It took a second.
"Hold it right there, bitch,"
he said, even though Bell had not moved at all.
"You assholes are going to help me get out of..."
Suddenly everything went wrong for Pavel Benka. The big, older black man with the sleepy eyes and laid-back voice was gone, and instead he held, or tried to hold on to, a whirlwind. Top turned inside the grip, twisting head and body toward Benka's shoulder, which unlocked the hold. A dark forehead snapped forward, crunching into Benka's nose, knocking him back. 2 iron-hard fists and a lightning-fast kick chased him, caught him, smashed him against the wall. Benka somehow clung to the pistol, pointed it, fired. Nothing. He staggered backward and racked the slide to put a round into the chamber, fired. Nothing. Top took the pistol away from him like a disappointed teacher, snatching the chalk from a dull student's hand.
"Oh, for fuck's sake," said Top. "You can't even tell from the weight that there's no bullets in the magazine. We won't even talk about how rude it is for you to assume I'm that slow and stupid as to bring a loaded gun into an interrogation room."
Benka spat blood from his mouth and threw a vicious hook punch at Top's head. Top walked into the swing, checking the punching arm on the point of his left elbow and driving his own fist into the center of Benka's chest. It was a heavy punch using only the prominent big knuckle of his forefinger, a spear punch to the center of the sternum that felled the mercenary as surely as a bullet to the heart. Benka hit the wall and slid down, coughing, gasping, fighting for breath.
A smarter man would have known this was a setup, son, said Top, but clearly you were never the brightest one in your class.
Fuck you,
he wheezed, and he tried to fit a triumphant smile onto his face.
You don't even know it yet, but everyone you love is already dead. And if you think I'm going to tell you a goddamn thing, then you're out of your fucking minds.
Top squatted down slowly, hooked a finger under Benka's chin, and raised his face until they met eye to eye.
I guess that means you probably haven't figured out how this works. The whole good cop, bad cop thing, no?
Well, here's the scary part. He leaned close and whispered,
I'm the good cop.
Smiling like everyone's favorite dad, he stood up, swapped the empty magazine for a loaded one, winked at Bell, and left. The door locked solidly behind him. Benka looked through the pain-induced tears in his eyes at the slim woman who still leaned against the wall. He saw her eyes, saw her smile, and knew he was lost. Chapter 105. Lucky Kim Internet Cafe, Sechon S, Gyeongsangnam-do, South Korea. Lieutenant Han sat on one chair and Bug on the other. Between them was An Il-tan. The cafe was empty except for one of Han's bodyguards. The other was outside somewhere. The shades were pulled down.
He said his name was Adam,
said An Il.
Last name?
Asked Bug.
Just Adam.
And he was in his 20s?
Sure. Yes. Maybe my age, 25 or so. He looks a little younger when he smiles like a big kid, but his eyes are older. And this is what he looks like?
Han held up her laptop to show the face Anil had painstakingly described. The identity replication software was very sophisticated, and Bug was impressed by how skillfully Han led the younger hacker through the process. The face that emerged was that of a very handsome young man who looked a lot like a younger version of the actor who played Captain America. A square jaw, blue eyes, full lips, good cheekbones.
Oh, said Anil. He had a scar, too. I forgot. It's small. Two scars, really, on his left cheek. A dot and a crescent. It's funny because it looks like a semicolon. How badly was his face burned when you blew up your apartment?
Asked Han.
Would he have had to go to the emergency room?
Anil chewed her lower lip for a moment, then shook her head.
I don't know. I hope his whole head burned off.
Bug tapped some keys on the laptop he balanced on his knees, then shook his head.
The police and firefighters reported no one home, no casualties, no one presenting at a local hospital with burns. All the pharmacies in town have CCTV,
said Anil. Bug grinned at her and hit more keys. Frowned. Tapped some more. Finally, he turned his screen toward Han. A camera feed from a pharmacy 16 blocks away showed a non-Asian woman picking up her bag at the checkout. Bug rolled it back and zoomed in, showing the gauze, ointment, and other supplies.
Wait, said Anil sharply. You found it that fast? How? Who are you people? And don't tell me you're cops, because I know what kind of computers cops have. I've never seen anything like that.
She stabbed a finger toward Bug's mind reader Q1 substation, and then at Han's Oracle.
Or that. I know computers. I know everything about computers, but I don't know either of those. So tell me who you are.
Bug cleared his throat.
We can't. Or at least not yet.
First, we'd like you to tell us everything from the beginning.
Again, I already told you 6 times. And each time you remember some detail you forgot the first time,
said Han.
A lot depends on it,
said Bug.
Will you guys promise to keep me safe?
Bug and Han both smiled.
You can count on that.
Anil wiped away a tear, sniffed, then nodded. Chapter 106. Oi Otera, the Blue Temple, Tsushima Island, Japan. The Orb Conference fell apart. Church stepped out in order to help local authorities in North Carolina understand the nature of the Rage threat. Nothing came officially from him, since he has no actual legal authority in the States, but he knew who to call. It seemed to me that since we left the U.S. over disputes with the current administration, key members on both sides of the political aisle have stepped up to form an unofficial network truly dedicated to the security of America. It was surprising but heartening to see big-picture thinkers take actions that earned them no party advantage, but actually spoke to a level of patriotism that ran deep. Made even a cynical old son of a bitch like me want to shake some hands. The first action was to quarantine the area. Agents in hazmat suits were dispatched into adjoining homes to find neighbors and isolate them in place. What that meant in practical terms was to put each of them in separate rooms in their own homes, bind them with zip ties, and trank them with Sandman. How the FBI got so many doses of Sandman that fast is something neither Church nor Wilson seemed to want to explain. Infants and very small children were transported to the local hospital. Teams armed with electronic scanners went hunting for the blowflies with orders to try and catch them in nets or bags so they could be studied. I sent Bunny and Andrea to check on Major Munn with orders to let me know as soon as she woke up. Because she was substantially smaller than the bad guy we bagged, her lower blood volume meant she'd sleep a bit longer. While I waited, I talked with Doc Holliday. "I'm trying to make sense of this," I said. "Forensics people on the scene estimate that the time of death of Burke's family roughly coincides with when we bagged him. How's that possible? I mean, why kill them all? They couldn't know Burke told us anything."
"Well, dang," said Doc. "I finally get a chance to fit a word in edgewise. I can answer that."
Her tone was sprightly, but that was forced. Her hologram was so sharply defined that I could see the horror in her eyes, and I felt certain she'd seen images from the Burke house. "What have you got?" I asked.
"I had the boys there at Aoi Otera strip your prisoner down to his skivvies and search his gear. Turns out he has a very sneaky and very nifty body cam. Don't know the make and model yet, but it's high-end and covered in film, so it can't be seen unless you're looking for it. It has some software built into it, and I'll bet you a dollar to a donut that the code is aligned to their jammer, so their signal gets out while everyone else's is scrambled."
"Which means Santoro and Bolton saw us," I said.
"Sure would. Your visors would spoil long-range views, like from a news helicopter or someone 40 feet away with a cell camera, but up close, yeah, they'd be able to see your faces."
"Well, that's a sobering thought," I said. "Bolton and Santoro both know my face."
"Well, honey lumps," said Doc, "they know it even better now."
Wilson rejoined us, and he looked gray and worn out. I knew it was going to be bad news.
I don't even want to.
"Go on," I said. "Hit me."
"On the odd chance that Major Munn is compromised, we send people to take her family into custody, but..."
He shook his head. "All of them?" I asked.
"Yes," said Wilson. "Her entire family is dead. Even the bloody dog. All dead. All by their own hands. It's bloody awful."
His choice of expletive seemed to catch up with him, and he turned away, his hologram blinking out. I stood there with Doc, each of us on different continents, thousands of miles apart, yet caught in the same bubble of sadness, anger, and dread.
"This is worse than a damn pathogen,"
she said bitterly, her cowgirl burlesque bodiness falling away.
"At least with a disease, there's a logical pattern to the spread. This is more like a sniper. You can't hunker down and hide because you don't know which way is safe."
"Is there some kind of antivirus?" "And no, don't say it. I know it's not a virus, not a bug, but you know what I mean, a counteragent."
"For a weaponized protein?"
I take that as a no.
"Honey, whoever designed this Rage thing is damn smart. Possibly a genius."
"Yeah?"
I said. I thought you were a super genius. Didn't Church hire you because you're supposed to be smarter than everyone else? Now might be a good time to prove that. She gave me a long, withering look.
Joe,
she said mildly,
use that tone with me again and I'll beat you like a tented mule.
Her image vanished and I was left alone, standing there in darkness wrapped in the barbed wire of my frustration and anger. Calpurnia lights, God damn it!
Please use respectful language, Joseph,
scolded the AI. I resisted punching the computer interface mounted on the wall. Instead, I stalked out of the room, but with no clear direction where to go. Chapter 107. Oi Otera, the Blue Temple, Interrogation Room 2, Tsushima Island, Japan. I saw Top standing outside of one of the interrogation rooms. He was eating sushi from a plate. He had a piece of gunkanmaki caught in the pincers of his chopsticks, but when he saw my face, he stopped from putting it in his mouth.
You're going to tell me there's more shit coming down the pipe, aren't you?
He asked. I pursed my lips for a moment and looked past him at the closed interrogation room door. He talking yet?
Barrel's with him, said Top. She's been in there for 10 minutes now.
That's enough time. Come on. He tossed the sushi into a trash can and unlocked the door. I could smell the blood as soon as we stepped in. There was not a lot of it, but it was fresh. That coppery smell is distinctive and fades to something else as the cells die and thicken. Pavel Benka sat weeping in the chair. The prison jumpsuit we'd put him in was rags. His body trembled as if with a fever. He sat rigid, as if afraid to move a muscle, as if doing anything at all was so terrifying that his muscles struggled to keep him there on that chair. I saw a pile of shackles in a corner. Benka was not tied or restrained by anything except terror. Belle leaned against the wall. She was breathing heavily but affected a resting state, like a cheetah who'd just outrun an unfortunate impala. Sweat jeweled her dark brown skin, and there were really unpleasant lights in her eyes. Her hands were red to the wrist. Without looking at the man, she said,
Tell them about the fixers.
I'm sorry,
he said, his voice disintegrating into blubbery tears, but Belle snapped her fingers loud as a pistol shot and his tears stopped.
Tell them.
Tears and snot ran down his face, into his mouth, dripping onto his chest. He told us. Chapter 108. Oi Otera, the Blue Temple, Tsushima Island, Japan. They're called fixers, I said. The orbs seemed to be a crowded house. My guys, Church, and everyone at the talk. Even Rudy was with us now. I made it a point not to walk through anyone this time. Our prisoner Pavel Benka knew Santoro from before and confirmed that he is training a new team. A large one, multinational. They are heavily funded and well-equipped.
Is Santoro working with Harcourt Bolton? Asked Wilson.
He didn't even know that name, I said, but he has seen Santoro with a tall American who fits Bolton's description, so we can probably make that leap. And I think we can also connect Bolton to Kuga. What's not clear is whether Bolton is Kuga or is employed by him. The reason that's unclear is because Benka talked about Kuga as if it wasn't so much a person as an organization.
I can understand that, said Rudy. Though I actually think that supports a supposition that Bolton is the man running that organization. Consider his past. He was in the CIA most of his life. He was a field operative used to submerging into whatever country or culture was necessary for his mission. Then when he became a criminal, he never self-aggrandized in the same way as, say, the Seven Kings. His focus was on his goals. Sharing a name with the organization is useful obfuscation.
So you think Bolton is both Kuga and the head of an organization called Kuga? Asked Church.
I do.
Nikki spoke up.
Rudy's right, I'm sure of it.
She went on to explain how the name Kuga has been picked up and used by a lot of criminals active in the black market and mercenary communities.
He's like McCavity, the mystery cat.
She looked around, saw a lot of blank faces.
From Cats? The one who everyone blames for everything but no one actually sees?
Moriarty, said Wilson.
Sure, she said. Whatever. I think that's also why he calls his guys the Fixers. After all, he's the ultimate fixer.
Church gave her a nod of approval. Your job now is to peel back the layers of deceit and misdirection and find the man. We need a better idea of the shape of his organization.
What did Benka tell you about the attacks on the islands?
Not a lot that we don't know, I said. He wasn't in on planning. Burke set it up and trained everyone for the missions. Benka was muscle. They used the blow-fly drones. On Frog Island, they collected as many as possible, but my guess is that a good forensic sweep will find them. I suggest that be a team effort with experts from all four countries. Make a show of it. Share the effort and share the win when they find stuff. Agreed, said Church, and Wilson said he would arrange it. Benka said that the hit in South Korea was the only other one he knew about. Those two hits.
Do you believe him? Asked Wilson. He could be lying to you.
He was not,
said Bell. Everyone looked at her for a moment, and she met the stares. Her eyes were about as human as those of a statue to some goddess of vengeance and slaughter. That's not a joke.
Fair enough,
said Wilson, looking uncomfortable. Rudy looked down at the floor and sighed. This kind of thing was so hard for him. Hell, it was hard for all of us, but what else could we do? Innocent people were dying, and we had no real idea how to stop it. After Frog Island, I continued, the strike team was to head here to Japan, split up, and make their way to a pickup point in Tokyo. That's where we may have caught our first useful break, said Wilson. The site is a warehouse, Kamikaze Jitensha, a bicycle manufacturer owned by Haruki Hong. He is half Korean, and when Nikki tore apart Hong's emails, she found some communication with businessmen in South Korea. By itself, that's nothing, because the firm buys parts from the South and also sells bikes there through a large number of retail outlets. Nikki, want to tell them the rest?
Nikki flushed a little and in her rapid-fire chipmunk voice said,
Kamikaze Jitensha makes mostly rental bikes for tourists. South Korea is their biggest market, and Mr. Hong visits several times a year. When I dug deeper, I found that Hong's grandfather was stuck in Pyongyang when the borders were closed and Korea split up. More than half the family was there, actually, still is, and despite all of the filters and restrictions the North Koreans put on any kind of internet or email, Mr. Hong has been swapping emails and even Skyping with his family there.
I said, ah, and meant it.
I have six people digging deeper, said Nikki, but so far we've already found some dirt. Mr. Hong's uncle, also in the north, is a big industrialist up there. Publicly, he's a good party member and supports North Korean isolationism, but he takes a whole different view in emails. And for the record, the Hong family uses a type of pattern encryption that I've only ever seen before used by people in the north. They send family photos, but when you blow up the images so that you can see the individual pixels, there are characters there in Korean. These are placed randomly by a 128-bit encryption program in order to hide the pattern and not trigger code search software.
But you found it anyway? Asked Rudy, smiling.
Her flush went five shades darker.
Well, sure. I mean...
She coughed and met nobody's eyes and finally found her way back to her point.
Read some filters and other stuff on the emails, and we're starting to be able to read some of them. The Hongs are complaining a lot, and I mean a whole lot, about how living in the North is killing their business and stifling growth. They have to pay too much to the state, and the trade sanctions imposed by America and other countries are crippling them. Lots of stuff like that. There's also a lot of bitching about China for fueling the North's hostility and keeping it locked in place as a buffer against the South, and by association, America. Hong's dad has made some cryptic comments about how the current situation is more fragile than it looks and only needs a push to fall down.
Ah, I said again. Boom, said Bunny.
We're still decoding. So far, except for the use of the bicycle warehouse, there's nothing directly tying the Hong family to Kuga. We still got a lot of emails to go through. I also have some of my guys writing a tapeworm program to get deeper into all the Hong family computers. We plan to attach it to Mr. Hong's next email. In the meantime, though, there was a reference that I found kind of odd, something that seems to be out of place. Four different members of the Hong family, Mr. Hong in Japan, his brother in Seoul, and the two elder Hongs in Pyongyang have all made kind of cryptic references to something called Dasut Myung E Kang Chul Namja, which means
the Five Iron Men, I translated. Church leaned forward sharp as a hawk. What was the context?
That's just it, said Nikki. There was no context in terms of the emails. That was all they said, just that name. What struck me, though, was the timing. Each of the family members sent the same email just before the attacks on Gaegu Li Siam and Yeonpyeong.
Church turned slowly toward me.
Now, isn't that interesting? He said slowly.
Chapter 109. Oi Oterra, the Blue Temple, Tsushima Island, Japan. Now that we had an actual solid lead, Church put the full machinery of RTI into motion, coordinating with Kingdom, with Arclight, and with a select few groups in the region where we had friends we could trust. It was a small list, though. After the Orb conference wrapped, I indicated to Church to linger a bit for a private chat. When we were alone in that strange virtual setting, I asked if he knew who these Five Iron Men were, because I got the impression he knew something.
Not personally, he said, but that name has come up before. There have been groups using that name for 1,000 years in Korea, always very political, but always tied to mercantile interests. The DMS hasn't had to go after them, but other organizations with which I've been associated have been aware of them. They were active during the Second World War, even during the Japanese occupation, working behind the scenes to make sure that trade flowed. It may be that they have been more aggressively active than was previously supposed.
Why didn't you say so to the group just now?
Because, Colonel, I may be culpable for some of the damage which has been done.
I gaped at him.
How?
He studied me for a moment, then sighed. He looked sad.
There was a time some years ago when I was involved in a matter in Korea and brushed up against the Dasut Myung E Kang Chul Namja. It was a crossroads moment, and I could have gone one way or the other, but not both. Had I chosen differently, then it is entirely possible that organization might have ended then. I chose what seemed like a better target, and helped take that down.
He paused. It was one of the first missions I undertook with Aunt Sally, quite a long time ago. She wanted to go after the Five Iron Men, but as senior agent I made a different call.
Who was the other target?
You would not have heard of them, he said. When it was clear I was going to wait for an actual answer, he said,
they called themselves the Builders. They pretended to be part of the Freemasons, but that was a lie, and they were not interested in building anything. Outwardly, they were a group of well-funded militant anarchists sowing hatred and violence throughout Southeast Asia.
What made you pick them instead of the Five Iron Men?
His eyes were black jewels behind the lenses of his glasses.
Because they were associated with Nicodemus.
Oh, I said.
Shit. Yes.
Nicodemus was a strange little man who has been involved in some of the worst and more frightening moments in my career with the DMS. I first encountered him during the King of Plagues matter. He was in a supermax prison at the time, but somehow managed to be actively involved in what the kings and the goddess were doing. Then he showed up again, and again after that, in Iran during the Assassin's Code case, in the Predator 1 case in San Diego, and then with the Dogs of War fiasco. Top and Bunny were fighting Nicodemus and losing, badly, when Church showed up. He chased my guys out and, as far as we can tell, killed the evil son of a bitch. Church absolutely refuses to talk about what happened and evades every conversation about Nicodemus that strays from what's in our main case files. They have a connection, though. That much is sure, and it is an old one.
How old? Good guess, because I can't even accurately figure out how old Church is. He looks like he's in his mid-60s, but there are rumors about him going way back.
Some of it is probably bullshit, like the rumors around the name Kuga. Even so, it gives me a serious case of the Wiggins when I think about it. Church scares me. Nicodemus scares us all. Is he dead? Even Church won't say for sure. You didn't take Nicodemus down that time with the builders, I said, aware of how unkind it sounded.
No. Did you stop the builders?
Yes.
Well, you have that at least.
Church is not a man much given to outward displays of emotion, but he looked like he'd been punched a few times in the gut.
Hard.
He shook his head.
I try not to carry regrets around, Colonel, he said quietly. Regrets are a cancer that can eat you alive. I'm not clairvoyant enough to look forward and see the full consequences of my actions. None of us have that luxury. We do what we think is best in the moment and then try to keep making the best choices based on the information we have. It's staying in the fight that matters.
The war is the war, I said. It was an important catchphrase for him, for me too, and for many of us in this field. The ones who understand that individual battles may be won or lost, but the war, that big, essential, endless struggle that puts guys like us between the devil and the world, goes on. After a moment, I said, this case, maybe it's because it's the first for our new outfit, or maybe because it's so international instead of being contained within the overall politics of the U.S. of A., but there is something deeply off about all this.
In what way?
I don't know. That's the problem. It doesn't feel right. It feels like we're only catching a glimpse, he said. We looked at each other.
Yeah, I said. A frustrating goddamn glimpse.
As I turned away, Church said, I'd like you and Havoc team to stay in Japan for a few days. The political situation there is calming down, but still tense. Since the leaders of the four countries are all in Oslo for the D9 summit, I'm going there. I've arranged a private meeting with them. Call it a calming down session with some creative spin control.
About that, if you're able to do that, then Bolton and Centauro have failed.
Their larger purpose, I mean. If these five iron men hired them to stage those bioweapon attacks, they got the small and ugly win, but they didn't really shake up the political situation. In a big picture way, our bad guys lost.
Perhaps, said Church. Stay here and find out for sure. Talk to Major Munn. Bug is in the South now and is interviewing the woman from Punk Press. Check with him to see if he has anything that could be a lead. I'll go play diplomat, Colonel. You stay here and be a cop.
And if we wrap it up here? He smiled.